Oscar, where's 1049 Park Avenue?
This is 1049 Park Avenue.
Can two divorced men share an apartment without driving each other crazy?
Hello, and welcome to 1049 Park Avenue, an odd couple podcast. Ted Linhart and Garrett Eisler here.
Gary,
I don't know who that is. Gary Marshall is not with us, but we do have a special guest this week. We're not going to be talking about a script, but we're very excited to have Peter K. Ackerman with us. He is the author of the book Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV, and he is the son of Eleanor Donahue, who some of you who listen to this podcast may also know as Miriam Welby. And Harry Ackerman, who I'm also a particularly big fan of because he plays a large role in another side of my television passion that Garrett refuses to get on board with, which is among many things, I Love Lucy.
I like I Love Lucy.
So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Congratulations on the book. It's available, I'm going to suggest, everywhere print and digital books are sold.
Yes.
And it's been out for how long?
A little over a month now.
Okay. Well, I saw your post. So the way this all started is Peter posted a picture of scripts on Facebook. And as our listeners know, we have been buying original scripts from a certain dealer who has access to them and discussing them and the differences. And then all of a sudden, I see someone else with a script and I did not realize it was the son of a person involved in the show. And then we saw what it was. It happened to be our first episode we ever did the podcast. I reached out, we started talking, and here we are.
Here we are.
So thank you for coming. So
first ever guest we have had who's related to someone in the show.
Really? Okay.
You're our closest connection to the show. We've had a couple of fellow fans on. So so it's great to have Miriam's son.
Yes.
Are you okay?
Master Welby.
Are you okay? Yes. I have a feeling you get referred to that because your mother has many famous characters she's played, which we will get into. So sure. You may be used to that, or maybe you're not. So let's start with talking about not your mother, because I think everyone knows who that is, and we will get to that in a bit. So why don't we talk a little bit, if you can give people a history on who your father is, because he is equally as important in TV as your mom. And I don't know if he's as well known, though.
Right. So his name was, he passed away in 1991. His name was Harry Ackerman, and he was the executive producer of many, many, many TV shows. Hazel, Bewitched, The Flying Nun, Gidget, the first season of Leave It to Beaver, Dennis the Menace. And that's just some of them.
And then what I discovered from reading your book, which I found fascinating, there's a number of things I found really interesting that maybe was out there or maybe you sharing for the first time, is that Sylvester Pat Weaver, who I know very
his
well.
His name was Sylvester?
So Sylvester Pat Weaver was the man who created The Today Show, created The Tonight Show, ran NBC, is the father of Sigourney Weaver.
Yes.
And per Peter's book, he helped your dad get his start or a major job in television. Can you tell that story?
Well, the story is going to be really short because that's about all I know. Somebody told me, see, I'm not much of a researcher. And when I wrote this book, Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV, I wanted to write it out of what I knew and what I observed. And because I work a full-time vocation, we'll get to that later. I didn't have the time to do like heavy duty research and go to the library and check out a lot of books and interview too many people that, you know, I'd have to kind of research of how to get in touch with them and all that. So all I know is that Pat Weaver was an alumni from Dartmouth University and my dad was a graduate from Dartmouth University. And I'm sure that connection was in there somewhere. And dad met Pat, probably wanting to get into that production arm of the business. And Pat gave him a job.
And he gave, that's what I'm saying. He did not give him a job directly in television. He gave him a job at an ad agency. which today is still very connected to the industry, but I believe even back then was more connected to the industry than even it is now.
Possible, yeah. Yeah.
Did you get to know him or meet him? I mean, he lived quite a while. He lived, I believe, past your dad. Did you ever get to spend time with him?
Not that I know of. There's always the chance that I met him, but I was a more of a visual person. So if I saw you on TV, I would right. obviously recognize you and know the connection between my dad. So at some point, he might have introduced me to a Pat Weaver. Later on in life, I think I would have been more thrilled to have met, I think it was Pat's brother, Doodles Weaver, who was
were they brothers?
Wait, there's a relation there somewhere.
Who is Doodles Weaver? I do not know that name.
I know.
Please, Garrett, go.
He was a famous comedian. I associated him with radio a lot, and he did the great bit Fetal Bomb, the horse race.
Yes.
Garrett, I think you should tell Harry who your father is.
I learned who Doodles Weaver is from my father, right? My father was a comedian of that era named Eddie Lawrence, and known for his bit, The Old Philosopher. So that's my connection to those golden age of television and radio.
All stuff. Right. Well, and as we're talking about that, just whoever wants to Google Doodles Weaver, and once you get a picture of him, you'll know you've seen him before, because he always showed up in films where he usually wasn't credited, but he had like beady eyes that were close together and just a typical character of the time.
He's kind of the routines I remember hearing are kind of a Spike Jones quality. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
That stuff.
Oh, well,
I'm going to
digress more, because my cousin, and this is not a joke, is the current Spike Jones.
You mean the director?
The director, Spike Jones, is my cousin.
I was about to say no relation, but
no relation.
Apparently, relation to you.
Yes. So we all knew that. We all have a familial connection on this phone, on this podcast. I'm looking up Doodles Weaver, and I can say I've never seen him before, which is rare where I don't know somebody. So I'm proud to be stumped here. But Doodles Weaver is really a sibling here. That's not a joke.
Not a joke on my part. I've always thought he was a sibling of Pat Weaver. And in fact, I know somebody who is my age. So when we were young, apparently he told me he lived near Doodles and would visit him and just hang out and talk to him. And
Sylvester
told me they were related.
Sylvester Weaver is a sibling. Sigourney Weaver is his niece. Yes, I see that here.
And was Doodles his given name at birth? Or does he?
Okay. All right. Here is his birth name. Ready? Winstead Sheffield Glendenning Dixon Weaver.
Wow.
That is what's listed on IMDb. All right. This has nothing to do with The Odd Couple. So we're going to keep going. All right. So you tell another story. There's a lot in the book. I highly recommend the book for people who love the classic era of early television. And even before that, because there's a lot of good, interesting there. There's a fascinating story that I've never heard before. I love. And again, I understand that the stories you're going to say are not necessarily any longer than the stories in the book. But can you tell the Orson Welles Pearl Harbor story?
Yeah. So I don't know what preempted it. Obviously, Pearl Harbor happened on a Sunday. So I've got to imagine that something was brewing. And my dad was maybe not at this time yet, the vice president of CBS on the West Coast, but he was on the West Coast. And apparently the news of something going on in Pearl Harbor was happening. And so he went down to the radio station at CBS, and Orson Welles was on. And I know Orson Welles used to do a noon poetry reading, I think on weekdays. So I don't know if that's what he was doing there on Sunday. And it came over the wire that we had been attacked in Hawaii. And like today, you can't just cut and go to the larger network. And the news anchors, and there was no news anchor in the studio at the time. They were doing whatever show they were doing. But Orson Welles was there, and Dad felt that that was the voice that needed to broadcast this news. But yes, exactly as you're thinking, others in the room said, you know, remember that War of the Worlds thing that happened a few years before? This might not go over well. And so after some hemming and hawing and talking, they just kind of went with the authoritative voice that Orson had. And so apparently, and I've never heard a recording of it, but he made the, I don't know how far this broadcast was going. It could have been local in Hollywood only. I don't know. But the Los Angeles area, Orson Welles on CBS made the announcement about Pearl Harbor.
Wow, fascinating.
That is fascinating. I never thought about the fact that his voice was essentially typecast as the voice of a fraud. I mean, never thought about that being a thing. I didn't realize he did radio. I mean,
especially in fact, after that was just a few years before.
That. Right. That was 30. Wasn't that 39?
I think so.
Yeah. So it's 2 years earlier.
37 to 39. I can't remember.
Yeah. Not in recent memory for the people listening.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. So I am a huge I Love Lucy fan. I sent you a picture, Peter, of a, I actually have a premium from the My Favorite Husband radio show. I have Desi Arnaz's biography he gave to his father. I know you have a great collection of stuff from your father we're going to talk about. I have Desi Arnaz's Bolex home movie camera. I collect a lot of I Love Lucy stuff. I watch every meal I eat, except when I eat dinner with my wife on Saturdays. I watch I Love Lucy. I'm obsessed. So can you describe...
Is that the only time you eat with your wife?
That's not... I think now I'm getting too personal on this podcast.
Well, I mean, you went there.
It's true, yes. Yes, it's true.
Okay.
Can you talk about your father's role in the creation of I Love Lucy, please?
Yeah, by the time I Love Lucy came around, Harry Ackerman was the vice president of CBS, and that meant he was stationed on the West Coast. William H. Paley, the president, was on the East Coast, and Dad's job was to kind of nurture the productions. He was, I call him the midwife. He would midwife radio shows into TV shows and then oversee the development of the TV shows on behalf of the network. You know, which still happens today on TV shows, network executives will come down and give their 2 cents, et cetera, with certainly smaller amounts of people in production then. Dad may have been the network overseer. So he was part of the development. And, you know, the three camera technique is it's kind of a bane. Is that the right word? Kind of a thorn in his side, I'll say, because everybody and their brother took sole ownership of the three camera thing. And Dad always told me, and not in defense, but it was a kind of group effort. They got together. It was my dad that brought together Al Simon, the camera fella, Al Simon. And of course the producer, Jess Oppenheimer, was there, and Desi Arnaz, producer and star of the show, was there, and probably Lucy was there as well. And they all kind of collaborated and agreed that she needed that sense of a live audience, and to capture that, they needed multiple cameras, which my dad as a CBS executive had used already on game shows. I think it was, I can't remember if it was Truth or Consequences or something like that, even Al Simon worked on that, had used multiple cameras before. So through that, they created the multiple camera. But if you hear about it today, depending on what source people go to, Desi gets full credit, Al Simon gets full credit, Jess Oppenheimer gets full credit. But really, my dad was a part of it, and it was a group credit.
That makes so much sense that it comes from other live TV formats. That was why that was such a genius application of that to a comedy, to a basically a dramatic format, you know, in terms of a fictional storytelling. But that really, right, that technique would have been developed for sports, game shows, other live talk shows and things like that. And right. And I'm sure it was not a natural adaptation. They really had to invent something.
And I'm sure those individuals named, like Al Simon, probably had to figure out how you take this application and use it on a soundstage with a comedy that you're filming, not a game show. And I'm sure they all had. And I remember, you know, Desi even called my dad once, and it might have been the time I talked to Desi on the phone as a boy. He called the house, and I ran to get Dad, and we were in Santa Barbara, and Desi called, and we were in a beach house, and Dad was in the pool, I think. And he said, well, let me dry off, tell Desi I'll be right there. So I went to the phone and told him that my dad would be right there. And Desi kept me on the phone and asked me, how I was, how old I was. And I remember the question, do you like the horse races?
So what year? I have so many things to say about this. What year do you think that phone call was?
Ooh, I'm going to guess around 72.
Oh, okay. So it was after, it was way after everything had all the Desi Lu. It was way after he was no longer part of it. Okay. So my understanding of the three camera topic, and I did not, the point that there should be multiple credit for it, I never thought about that. Desi wanted it. CBS was willing to give Desi and Lucy the rights to the episodes of the show. There was some financial transaction where Desi and Lucy gave something up, and in exchange for that, Desi and Lucy got the episodes. And CBS never thought about the fact that there were repeats that would have value over time. But in order to do that, they had to find a new way to record the episodes, because the prior way was the way the Honeymooners did it, where it was broadcast live on the East Coast or East Coast. And then there was that system that I can't think of the name of now that was very inferior, that kept it for the West Coast feed, but not good enough for syndication. And I always thought of the story is that Desi Arnaz created syndication by creating the three camera model. And what you're pointing out, which makes a lot of sense, is it wasn't just all Desi Arnaz. The credit should probably go around to multiple people.
Right. And Desi, in telling this, I always fear that the opposite will happen. I'm not trying to say Harry Ackerman did it all.
Yes.
And throw everybody else down. What my dad was the type of person, didn't matter what you did, if the CBS page, you know, or the janitor sweeping the stage came up and said, hey, I've got a great idea, my dad would have listened to the person and considered the idea.
So going back a little earlier, so there was a radio show with Lucy and Richard Denning called My Favorite Husband. Richard Denning, others you may know, he played the governor on Hawaii Five-0 for all 12 seasons. And when they were going to bring the show to TV, Lucy wanted to bring her real life husband, Desi, and CBS said, well, who's going to believe you're married to a Cuban? She pointed out, well, it's true in real life. And they fought and got it. Do you know that if your father was involved in that topic?
He had to have been. And I know I've read a few Lucy books. I've forgotten if that was covered in there. If my dad is mentioned in a Lucy book, I always feel that has an author has made something knowing what they're talking about. And so I've read those. Knowing Dad, he was a man who could be persuaded, and he wasn't a person to draw a line in the sand and stick to his side of the line. So he could, again, be persuaded. And I think if I had to, I'm really just casting a narrative here that I don't know, but he would have supported what the cast wanted, and probably was the one who went to Bill Paley and said, listen, this will work. They're married in real life. We can advertise that as well. Whatever CBS would need to help sell it to the country, my dad would have supported.
I'm a bit angry with you, Peter. I wish you because you love TV, had gotten your dad or sat with your dad to write down all the stories and have him write a book. Why didn't that happen?
Dad tried to write a book, and he donated his papers to Dartmouth University. I could always go and look at them, but I remember digging through he kept his papers, which were in these big folders in a desk in the living room at home. And every once in a while, I would just go exploring. And all I remember of a Harry Ackerman book was a couple paragraphs written. So I don't know that he had that desire, talent, patience. Nowadays, if you want to write a book and you have enough money, you can pay a ghostwriter and be interviewed and let somebody else write the book in your voice. And back then, I think you had to actually write the book. It wasn't such an industry as it is now. And he just didn't have the patience. And probably when he did have the time in between producing, when work was scarce for him, I don't know that he thought people would care about it.
I think back then
nostalgia hadn't come around yet.
That's a good point. I guess I should not. I will take away the anger and say thank you for writing your book, because you've done the best you can.
Yeah, he wrote it. Ted,
he did. Right. Wrote the book. It's he fair. I rescinded my anger. Didn't you hear me say that?
Yeah. Well, it is funny, hearing when you asked that, Ted. Like, I thought to myself too. Like, I wish that I had, I mean, I had a lot of time with my father to learn a lot of things, but I know there was more. And, but you know, when it's your dad, you don't.
Yeah.
Your dad also is in the, was in the industry, Ted, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't necessarily, it takes a long time for you to think about, oh, I should sit down and interview my dad. Like,
it's fair. It's fair. It's a fair point.
You just kind of absorb the stories. And as Peter was saying, you know, you notice things and you pick up things. And yeah, I kind of wish I earlier had the impulse to actually document some things, but it is what it is.
All right. So let's move on. Please continue.
No, I was going to say about my parents. Another facet of that is they didn't brag. You know, these were jobs, projects. And when they were over, project done, on to the next project. And yeah. I was raised in a household that was kind of like my dad's TV shows. It was just, there was a dad, there was a mom, there was this boy and three brothers living under the same roof. And dad didn't talk, you know, walk around with a big cigar saying, hey, guess what I did today? Or remember the days when I did this? And there was no bragging. They just, it was like anybody's parent going to the office or going to work. They just,
and he really, I must say, your father especially seems like typical to me of a good behind the scenes man. Like he was a producer in an industry at a time when those were not famous name. Now they have their own production companies, their own publicists, their own. And he really clearly was valued by people like Weaver and Paley because he was obviously so dedicated behind the scenes and letting the stars be the stars.
Right. We should say your mom.
And for years.
Yeah, go ahead.
Before my mom, for years, people would ask me, what does an executive producer do? And I said, I don't know.
I'm not sure I know. I work in television. I don't even sure I know what they do. We should say your mom is still with us and doing well.
Doing well. Yes, you can you can say that with clarity. You know, she was a lifelong dancer. She was entertaining professionally when she was 2 years old. And she has danced all her life. I don't think she's danced for the last 10 years, but now she swims every day. She's married to my stepdad. They've been married longer now than my parents' marriage was, which went just shy of 30 years. He died right before their 30th wedding anniversary. And my mom and stepdad have been married for 30 some years now. And she swims every day and she considers herself retired. She doesn't do the autograph shows anymore. And she likes being retired. She won't even do autographs. If somebody sends her something in the mail, she just sends it back because she wants to just be Eleanor at home in Palm Desert and just kick back and swim.
So. And I should say, I did ask Peter about his mom doing our podcast, and you believe that would probably not go very far.
Yeah, I could tell you that she'll say no, thank you.
Yes, right. So, so let's move on a little bit chronologically with your dad. There's a lot. We're going to cover one other show and another topic before we get to your mom, Bewitched. So Bewitched, arguably, or maybe even not arguably, his most successful producing show, 8 seasons, 254 episodes. And as I pick up in the book, Elizabeth Montgomery, who I'd say many kids our age had crushes on when Bewitched was on, really became like family to you. Can you talk about her and your relationship with her?
Quite literally family. She was married to Bill Asher, who was the producer of Bewitched and also directed many of the episodes. And since we've been talking about I Love Lucy, he directed a lot of I Love Lucy episodes. And we were close. Bill was Dad's business partner, if you will, on Bewitched. And probably other projects. And we just became close. However it happened, my mom and Liz became a competition. They both wanted to have girls. And so around the time I was born, Bill and Liz had their first boy. Bill, I knew him as Willie. I think he's Bill Asher Jr. now. And then my younger brother, James, was born and they had Robert. And then... for the race for the girl, they each wanted a girl. And my mom had my baby brother, Chris, and Elizabeth had Rebecca. So Liz won. And they were over every weekend. The whole family was over every weekend. We'd go to Rams football games together. And we Ackerman boys called Liz and Bill, Uncle Bill and Aunt Liz. And they were like an uncle and aunt. They were just over all the time. They were family.
And what I appreciate about your book is you don't hide the tough stuff that happens in life. So can you talk about how the show Bewitched ended, which was because of personal problems that impacted your relationship with them and really sounded quite upsetting and sad?
Yeah. So I was, I always forget the dates now. Maybe it was 72, 74, whenever the last season was. So I would have been 9 or 10. And Dad had dropped me off at the set and they were filming an episode, and it's in my book and the name escapes me now. And the scene that they filmed ended up not being in the episode, but it was where Sam ate something that the rest of the episode was about. I think she got spots on her face and they had to call Dr. Bombay to fix it. And things were happening, of course, because the spots made her magic happen without her trying to. So we're filming that first scene and Dad dropped me off at the set. I was allowed to sit in his director's chair, and Liz and Dick Sargent said, yeah, we'll watch him, Harry. And so I sat between them and we played a game that was in the LA Times, and Liz had me play a trick on Dick. She told me there was some puzzle that she had to figure out, a jumble puzzle. And she whispered it in my ear and said, don't tell Dick I told you. And so when Dick came back to his seat, I said, I figured out the puzzle. It's blah, 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 whatever the answer was. And he's like, oh, Liz told you, didn't she? And I said, yeah. And it was all fun and great. And then they went and filmed the scene, and the scene ended with her again. I think it was fainting. And Bill, her husband, wasn't directing this. Uncle Bill wasn't directing it. It was another gentleman. And in Liz's fainting in the scene, she sort of twirled to the ground and it ended up with her rear end. I think she was wearing jeans, kind of sticking out towards the crew, if not to the camera. And the director said, oh, Liz, honey, I could watch that all day. And there was kind of nervous laughter in the crew.
Wow.
And again, I was brought up in this sort of father knows bestie type house. And my mom did what Liz does. And it was like saying that to my mom, and nobody seemed to get mad. And Liz laughed at it. And I thought, what's that about? And fast forward again, time in my young mind, I'm not sure how long it was, but Bewitched was going to be ending. And on a Saturday morning, Liz called the house and my dad talked to her, hung up the phone and went back to breakfast. And my mom says, what was that all about? And he goes, well, Bewitched is over. And she says, what happened? He goes, well, Liz called me. She and Bill are getting a divorce. And she wants this fella who was directing that episode to be the new producer. And she said she will go on as the network wanted her to go on and do another season. She said she'll do another season as long as this guy's the producer. And my dad said, no, Bill's my partner. I'm not going to do that to him. And she said, well, then Bewitched is done. And Dad said, it's done. And so that's how it ended.
And then your relationship got strained. Your family's relationship got strained with her after that. There was a comment made at some party, or one of your brothers made a comment that was not right, and it was all misconstrued.
Well, I don't know if it is the fact we all know now, divorced people, it's quite common. And often when people divorce, their friends split up. And so we may have gone with the Bill Asher side because my dad and Bill stayed friends. And that same day that I overheard my parents' conversation, I wasn't sitting at the table with them. They were having breakfast and I was just a quiet kid who liked to listen. And so I listened, and that's how I heard it. The Asher kids came over with Bill later that day, and we were playing on our Ackerman treehouse in the backyard. And I was talking to Willie and I said, did you hear about your parents? And he goes, yeah, they told us that they're no longer in love. They each love us, but they're not going to be married anymore. And I said, I heard your mom was in love with the director. And it was an innocent comment. And fast forward to Christmas time, we were all excited because Bill and the kids were coming over for Christmas. And suddenly Bill Asher showed up with a bunch of Christmas gifts wrapped as a bachelor would wrap them. And my mom said, wait, where's the boys? Where's Rebecca? And he said to her, Liz doesn't want them coming over here anymore. And I always felt at that moment, and I didn't tell my mom until I was writing this book, that I think I'm the one who split it, because Willie probably went home to his mom and said, Peter Ackerman says you're in love with this person, and probably didn't go over well.
What did your mom say when you finally told her that?
I maybe just laughed about it. I mean, just giggled. I mean, it's water under the bridge.
50 years ago now. Yeah. All right. So one other topic I want to talk about your dad before we get to your mom. I'm a collector. He's a collector. And it's the list of stuff that the few things you even mention in the book about what he collects. He had Lincoln's wallet and pocket knife. He had a check that Lindbergh signed to buy the instrument panel for Spirit of St. Louis. He's a Raymond Chandler book inscribed to your dad. Is this just scratching the surface? And do you still have this stuff?
No, I don't have any of this stuff. Most of it got sold in auction after he died in 1991. And he was a collector. He loved history. And he also, I guess, loved opportunity. So when he was with CBS, he was overseeing the Adventures of Raymond Chandler radio show. And though I don't think the author Raymond Chandler penned any of the episodes, Dad would go down to La Jolla, where Raymond Chandler lived, and talk about episodes and get some feedback from Chandler about, oh no, do it this way or do it that way. And one day Dad was heading down to La Jolla, California, and he was a little early, and then bookstores were everywhere, and he just decided to waste some time in a bookstore, and he found some just hardcover copies, not first editions or anything, of some Raymond Chandler books, I think three of them. And he bought them for whatever they were then, $7 each. And he took them to Raymond Chandler's house and had Chandler sign them over to him. I do have whichever one it is. I do still have somewhere, not around me now. It's in a safe somewhere. A Farewell, My Lovely, signed to Harry Ackerman from Raymond Chandler, La Jolla, California, with the date. And the Lincoln wallets, that definitely went in the auction or before. We hit some hard financial times when Dad's shows went out of favor and we started going to the quote unquote then edgier shows like All in the Family. The Harry Ackerman shows just didn't go any longer. Dad sold some stuff just to kind of keep afloat. And one of them, the Lincoln wallet, besides being able to pick up the last legal wallet owned by Lincoln, and he had burned, however he did it back then, he had burned his initials in them, or his first initial and last name in them. So handwritten, burned forever autograph in this legal wallet. Dad bought it at an auction. And the story was just great, is that among Lincoln's things, one thing that went missing when he died was his pearl-handled pocket knife, which he carried around with him all the time. And people thought it was fell out of his pocket after he was assassinated or was stolen or what have you. And so Dad bids on the legal wallet, gets it, and goes to collect it, does the money exchange, and he's walking away, and he opens up the wallet, and he notices that a couple of the folds are stuck together. So he peels them apart, and there's a pocket knife in there.
Oh, wow.
And so he went to the auction people, because Dad was an honest person, and he said, and it had Lincoln inscribed in that, probably not an autograph, probably a jeweler did that one. It was a white pocket knife with a little gold seal, and it had A. Lincoln written on it. And Dad said, this was in here, and I didn't bid on this. And they said, well, you bid on that and everything that's in it, so that's in it, you get it. So he found this treasure that had been missing for so many years.
That's fantastic. And was this just the surface, like, were these the key items, or did he have like 50 other things that would make a whole other book?
Probably a whole nother book. I mean, I'd have to, I'm not a big Napoleon Bonaparte fan, but it was Napoleon, right before one of the big battles, wrote to the other general, and the other general wrote him back a note. And my dad owned both. And he had them framed with the picture of Napoleon here and the picture of the other general here. And he put them always on opposite walls wherever. So
that's great. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So stuff like that. My dad loved presidential things. He had a book that it wasn't a book. He had a collection bound together, and I think it went through Nixon. but it was something signed by every U.S. president up through Nixon.
I know another collector has one of those. I really wish I could have met your dad. We have so much in common. It sounds like I could have talked to him for hours.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
All right. So we're going to move on to your mom in the interest of time. She has a long career. I do want to hit multiple things, but obviously we're going to spend most of our time in The Odd Couple. But we can't miss the fact that she first became very famous for being Betty Anderson on Father Knows Best, 6 seasons. And at the time, they were doing more than 30 episodes a season. So even though she only was on 6 seasons, it's almost 200 episodes. I'm not a fan of the show. I have not really seen it. So I don't think we're going to spend time on the show itself. But I was fascinated to find out, and I don't know how well known this is, that during that show, she was pregnant with your brother, Brian, and she was basically playing a teenage daughter on the show. Was that something that, like, did you reveal that to the world, or was that known very well before your book?
I think I've revealed it because people still look at the Father Knows Best family as the perfect nuclear family of the 1950s. You know, if you had to put a case study together of what the nuclear family
was. Right, sure. It's always mentioned along with Leave It to Beaver. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so she got married during the run of the show. She was older than her character.
Not to your father.
No. My dad adopted my brother, Brian. So by the time they were married and by the time I was born, I'm the first of their offspring, but my dad adopted Brian. So I grew up in a household with him as my older brother. And so she married a sound technician, Brian's dad. The marriage didn't last. And then later on, the technician took his own life and they had Brian. And so there she was, probably on one of the later seasons of Father Knows Best. And they, throughout the season, and I haven't studied the show, I'll watch it when it comes on. It was the first thing I ever saw with my mother on it while I was sitting on my mother's lap. A rerun was on and she pointed herself out to me. So I get all that. And apparently there was a season where she was starting to show. And so they hid it. And the network had to hide it because you couldn't have America's daughter pregnant. And so I think it was even hidden from the press that she was having a baby.
And the fact that you could hide it from the press shows the significance of those times.
Yeah. Who is the head of Columbia Pictures? It's the
Sam, fellow. Sam Cohn. Is that you're talking about?
Harry Cohn.
Harry Cohn can do anything. Apparently he had his fingers in everything and could put pressure on people.
Cause they own the show. They own the show.
Yeah. And Groucho Marx was known to say at Cohn's funeral that Groucho showed up just to be sure that he was dead. So they hit it with my mom would maybe peek in from the doorway and say something or be shown with holding up laundry. But there's this one episode, I guess they had to do a Betty centric episode once in a while. And I forget the title of it, but it's the point of the episode is that she was able, with the help of her family, to run the race and win the high school race on the track team she was on, and also show up and dress and be ready to be prom queen or homecoming queen, whatever she was. And if you notice, the shirt she's wearing for the race is like the largest t-shirt ever for a, you know, average size skinny woman like my mom was. And every once in a while, if you're looking for it and you see her turn, you can see a belly under the t-shirt. And the dress is hilarious. The homecoming dress, the waist goes to about up here, you know, and it's very fluffy from right below the chest. And so they did everything they could to hide the pregnancy.
And if you want to learn more about how she got onto Father Knows Best in early career, I recommend you pick up the book because Peter does a great job describing it. All right, let's talk about The Odd Couple. So can you generalize, share?
By the way, segue.
Yes, yes.
Well, I know you want to talk about Robert Young.
Oh, yes. All right, I forgot to. I did. You're right. I want to go back. Yes, yes.
Hardcore Odd Couple fans know this, but apparently, and I think I've heard your mother confirm this in other interviews, that Felix gave Miriam the name Welby because he knew her from Father Knows Best and kind of combined that with Robert Young's other show, Marcus Welby.
Yeah.
Do you know that? Has she shared that with you also?
She has not, but I've known my mother, if not other people, but my mother has done soap operas, and every once in a while they had a general character that wasn't named for whatever reason, and she would suggest a name. Days of Our Lives, there was a Coast Guard, and at the time my younger brother James was in the Coast Guard, and instead of being Coast Guard person number one, she asked if it could be Officer Ackerman or something like that, and they said yes, and so that naming is probably done a lot in Hollywood with kind of a wink.
Yes, and Garrett reminds me, so you tell a story in the book in the Father Knows Best reunion in the 70s that Robert Young, who I believe committed suicide, am I correct?
No, he tried. He was
he tried. That's right. He tried. Yes. Yeah. And then he ultimately passed away. Not that, but he did try. But he had his own demons, as you write, and you had a bad experience with him. We don't have to recap it now. It's in the book. But do you believe that during the run of the show, did your mother ever say, was he also kind of like an unpleasant person, or did that really happen later?
No, he was definitely a father figure. And I know that she had some respect. My mother will never talk poorly about anybody. Mm. And the secret I know, and I've seen other talent do this, whenever you refer to the person as Mr., it means they're sort of one, they're held at arm's length. Like my mother will talk about Jane Wyatt, and she will say Jane, Jane, Jane. And they were like mother and daughter throughout Jane's life. And they were very close. But frequently I will see my mother interviewed in the past, and when Robert Young comes up, she doesn't call him Robert. She calls him Mr. Young. And there's, I'm not going to say anything more. She doesn't do that with the Odd Couple guys. It's always Tony or Jack.
Got it.
It's a code that I don't even know if she does it. It's a tell for me.
Right. I got it. Okay. Understood. All right. So before we get into details, can you just summarize what you know about your mother's experience on The Odd Couple, how she got it, her experience during the show, anything you can share, just, you know, stream of consciousness, and then we'll ask you a specific question.
All right. Well, the thing, whenever you say Odd Couple and my mom, the first thing I have to get out of the way is what I detest that all my friends loved, especially in reruns as I got older, was what they called hot pants, because Marianne would sometimes wear these short shorts with your hot pants.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, she's my mother.
Right, right.
I was not going to bring that up, by the way.
Yeah, she was looking at her now, and I look at them when we've been watching so much for the podcast. Yeah, you know, they definitely styled her as a kind of a modern woman, but in a very 70s way. And these hot little outfits. So I don't know what your friends meant. Yes.
And I don't know how she got cast. Knowing that it was the richness of that, what a great cast that show had from you know, the guest actors and the other semi regulars. Murray the cop,
Al Bornaro.
Yes, Al. Just stellar cast. And so I'm sure Mom auditioned, and they said yes, she's the one, and she got it. And I know it was a busy time for her. And it was also such a learning experience. One thing that gets forgotten, and you don't see it until she plays something different, like on The Love Boat. As silly as people will just say, oh, the person did a Love Boat episode. Love Boat sometimes gave an actor a chance to do something different. And she frequently, after Father Knows Best, and after even Odd Couple, she would be cast in something where they wanted her to play a grown-up Betty Anderson, you know, the sweet, wholesome girl. And The Odd Couple, and she really was a good actress. I mean, if you saw her on stage, if you saw her on some episodes of The Love Boat where she had to play a mean character, she was really a good actress. And where was I going with this? I'm starting to lose my train of thought.
Saying how there was something challenging. She learned a lot working on the show.
Yes. So the comedy, Gary Marshall was this master. And I remember it would be great when she would come home. We didn't have family dinners except for special Thanksgivings and such. So we boys would have dinner early, and then Mom and Dad would have dinner around the time we boys were going to bed. But I would sometimes listen and hear their conversations, and sometimes she'd share them with me. But how Gary Marshall, I remember her sharing, had such a cue to funny. And it's something that you either learn to make innate. Is that the right word? You learn to kind of internalize it, but and you can only study it a bit. But she came home once and she shared how they were trying to come up with a word about something as part of a joke. And somebody said, oh, how about hippopotamus? And Gary Marshall had said, hippopotamus isn't funny. You've got to have a hard K for it to be funny. Chicken is funny. And so I think it became chicken. And whatever the joke line was, they did chicken. And I learned that. And that was just one of the things I picked up and filed away about what's funny. And so she was really with talented people with that cast. I mean, again, it was all the cast, the producers, directors, just a time where she was surrounded by talent.
And
this goes with the talent too. I'll say she sometimes didn't know when she was working or not. I was very aware if mom was going to be home or not this week or the next. And during The Odd Couple, if I was a betting person at the time, I could have, you know, laid odds one way or the other and bet my friends if my mom was going to really work or not, because sometimes Marion was written out of a script by the time they filmed it in front of the audience. She'd get paid for whatever rehearsal day she did, but then they would decide, no, let's do this scene differently and not have Marion, but it could work the other way. So I remember a night when we were going to have a family night and play Parcheesi, and we were going to sit around and do a game and all that. And the phone rang at about 4 o'clock and they said, Eleanor, we need you down here at the set. We've decided to add a scene with Miriam and we need you here. And so, boom, she had the night off and now she doesn't. So it was, and it just kind of shows from a household end where I was, the, sure, the creativity of the show, that they didn't have it in the can by the time they were bringing it to the audience on show night. They were still working on it.
So that's fascinating, because as we're reviewing these scripts, and we have probably 8 to 10, there are many changes, not as drastic as no Miriam in the script, Miriam in the show yet. So I'm very curious. I'm sure you don't know what episode that was, but we're finding that there's so many things that happen in the script and don't happen in the show and vice versa, including, which I'm going to get to a bit, an episode that your mother was in with the most famous line ever from the show is not in the script. So it's fascinating to hear you say that they added Miriam at the last second. And we know all the Miriam episodes. I'm not sure what that could be off the top of my head. And I don't think either of you probably know. Right. No. And you met Tony and Jack, you were on the set, and you, in your book, you indicate that you got a very nice greeting from Tony, but Jack was a little gruffer.
I hope I put this in my book correctly. No, Jack wasn't Tony. So where the gruff came is my mom warned me that Jack could sometimes be short.
Oh, okay. Then I may have misread that.
So we were walking from the dark part of the set. You come in from the outside and it's dark because it wasn't a show day. And we're going to the lit part of the set. And my mother leaned over to me and said, now I'm going to, she probably saw them there. That's why she did this. And she said, now I'm going to introduce you to them. She goes, just know that Jack can sometimes be a little short. It's not personal. And so it just could have been his way. And maybe it was on a Thursday, the day before they filmed or something. And that's how he was on Thursdays. I don't know, but I met Tony first and shook his hand. He shook mine. And then it's kind of a typical Tony Randall, as he took sort of a few steps back and put his hands down in front of him, folded together, and kind of looked me up and down and said, well, how are you, Peter? And I'm so glad you're here. And it was just such a gentleman. And then she escorted me over and said, excuse me, Jack, I'd like you to meet my son, Peter. And he goes, Peter, hello there. I'm Jack. Nice to meet you. And just exactly what you'd expect. He was nice and kind and exchanged a few words. And that was it.
In the book, you say received a gruff yet friendly hello from Jack Klugman. Okay. That's what made me think of it. Is that fair to say that's still probably?
Absolutely. In comparison, it wasn't the Tony Randall sort of step back.
Yes.
Give me all the attention. It was kind of, oh, hi, Peter. Nice to meet you. You know, yeah.
And they got, she got along very well with both of them. Did she obviously spent more time just at least on the show with Felix. Oh, I just realized I forgot to do something with Felix. But I assume she spent equal time with both, or did she get to know one of them more than the other, you think?
I don't know. It was always just a professional relationship. So she never has talked in my hearing or to me about, what it was like working with them. I'm not even sure where I just recently heard an anecdote, whether she told it to me or I heard it on your podcast or I saw it on an interview on YouTube or something, but a time where Tony got very frustrated with her, and it could happen. And
we played a clip of this on our podcast. Yes.
It may have been one of her earliest episodes, if not her first.
Yeah. She did an interview, I think, with the Academy, or she had a very long interview, I think, with the TV Academy. We played that clip. Yes. But I think ultimately you would say she ended up being friendly with both of them, but not something like a Liz Montgomery where it stayed a lifelong friendship, or am I wrong?
Not that I know of. And Liz wasn't a lifelong friendship either, because the divorce.
Fair point. But as close a friendship as that, she never got as close to them.
And again, my mother would say, if she was here, what people don't know, and you've heard this, I'm sure, before from others, or nobody knew then that we would still, these many decades later, be watching these same shows and dissecting them and looking at them. They were just jobs. And you did this job. It was a short time job. It would end. It could be an episode. It could be a few seasons, but it would end and you'd go on to the next job. And you didn't. And you learn to say goodbye to people. I guess the people that she stayed closest to were from Father Knows Best, because she did some growing up at that time. And not to jump back to the other show, but the actors who played her siblings on the show remain close today. And she was very close with Jane Wyatt. It was like another mother for her. Jane was. And Odd Couple. They're all adults now, and adults, a job ends, all adults go to the next series.
Right, and your mom had a family, and it's interesting to hear you tell from your point of view how it felt like that it was unpredictable sometimes when she'd be on it, because it's a reminder that Miriam, as with a lot of the supporting cast, they were not regulars as much as we think, as you might assume. Like, they seemed to write, they used all their supporting cast as needed. I guess Al Molinaro became the closest to a lot. It would be rare that he wasn't in it in some way, but no one else really had that status. And but yet she made such a strong impression that we of course think of her in the top, three or four actors in the show. And she was only she was in seasons 3 through 5. I think her first episode
season 3, episode 1. Yeah. But we think of her, if there's 5 stars of The Odd Couple with Myrna and Miriam, there's 5. So, but you're saying that she didn't realize then that in 2024, 2 schnooks would be talking about her on a podcast.
and the one schnook that's her son would be talking with her.
Now she was there when John Lennon showed up, which is a story that Garrett reminded me, which you tell in your book. Harvey Miller, I think we know, told that story also. But can you tell what you recall of your mother met him right there? Yeah, because his girlfriend at the time, I'm going to tell a little story, then you tell of it. May Pang knew who she was and introduced her to John Lennon. Am I telling that partially correct?
No, it happened a little bit differently. Okay. So we know that John Lennon went to Paramount because there's a famous picture of him on the Happy Days set. And I'm sure Gary Marshall, I think, is in that picture and probably said, hey, we're doing a run through of The Odd Couple on set, whatever, stage, whatever. Go come with me or go over there. And so my mom is doing whatever. She's got, I think they were off script then, or maybe not, because they were rewriting lines. She had her pencil, and suddenly the script supervisor said, look, it's John Lennon. And my mom looked over, and there in the front row is John Lennon with an Asian lady and two young boys, because apparently it was Julian who brought a friend. And my mom is always, to this day at 87, there's still this little girl inside of her who loves fame and loves autographs. So, and she had, my mom had four boys and we were listening to Beatle music. So she tore off the back of something, either her script or a call sheet. She ran over with her pencil and she said, "Mr. Lennon, may I have your autograph to my boys?" And he said, "Of course." And he goes, "What are their names?" And so he wrote to Brian, Peter, James, and Chris, "Love, John Lennon." And she said, "Thank you very much," and walked away. And later on, I reached out to May Pang and asked her if she remembered it. And she goes, "Oh, yes." And May said that she leaned over to John and said, "Do you know who that is?" Because May did. And John's like, "No." And because John didn't grow up with American television in the 50s. May Pang knew my mom from Father Knows Best. Right. So we had that for years. And my mother gifted it to me at some point, and I framed it with a picture of John, and I had it for years. And I've just moved across the country too many times, and I finally decided to sell it, and I did. And some other collector has it with the story. So
That was my next question. I'm glad you, I was scared you're going to tell me you lost it. So I'm very happy to hear that you did not lose it. It was gifted to or sold to somebody who will cherish it. Yes. So now speaking of that, I'm going to make a public plea here to you. You mentioned, so the way I found you was you put a picture of these scripts. Oh, I had a lot of my mom's scripts. I recycled them. I don't know what that means. Please, if these next group of scripts do everything recycling, please, I will purchase from you if necessary. The Pen Is Mightier script, any Odd Couple scripts, I plead with you.
Right. Well, my mom knew I always wanted to be an actor, and whether I was in acting class or not, she would just come home with a script for something she did. And she'd say, "Here, do you want this?" And I'd always say, "Yes." I was a little bit of a pack rat then. And then I found in my early life, moving out of the house and into my own apartment and then getting married and moving into another apartment, I was moving these boxes of scripts and I wasn't looking at them anymore. And nobody seemed to want them. And this is in the days of pre-eBay and everything else. So, yeah, just took them to a recycling, I don't say dumpster, but put them in the paper recycling
thing. Breaking my heart. You're breaking my heart.
Sorry. Mine too. Oh, mine too. I could have been the guy on eBay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then recently, I've got all these boxes still. And I finally said to Marie, my wife, I never organized any boxes. So it's like, and we keep moving and not opening boxes. And I think we're solid for a while. And so I opened up a box and found there were five scripts that I hadn't thrown away. And so, no, I'm not going to throw them away. I'm going to keep them, cherish them.
Okay.
When I don't, I will.
Thank you. I will. I'll have a blank check ready. The Pen Is Mightier Than Pencil is our first episode. It's one of my favorites. We're going to play a clip from it in a bit. And that's the one that you have. And it's not her, it's her second episode, I believe. So I'm very glad that that exists. So here's the question I asked you on Facebook, and you did on Facebook when we were messaging, you were ready to chat, to channel your mom discussing Miriam. So we're going to do it again. Right. This is something we've talked about on the podcast. Miriam was dating Felix. Felix spent a lot of time talking about how he wants to get back with his wife and also dating other women during the show while dating Miriam. And we would always ask, what does Miriam think about this? Miriam must realize there is no future in this relationship with Felix. Does she care? Are they in love? Sometimes they see platonic. Sometimes they talk about being not platonic. And what do you think your mom would say about, and I know she never thought about this during the show because why would she? But what would she say today about what Miriam thinks about the status of her relationship with Felix, who did not really seem to be that into her?
I would say that she would say that, remember, Miriam was a modern woman, which was kind of new in the 70s. She was not the Betty Anderson of Father Knows Best. She was a modern woman. And so Felix was into Miriam, but then also into other women, wanted to be back with his wife. He was all over the map. Maybe Miriam dated some other fellas too.
Yeah, it just made me think of that, right?
Yeah. And so I think she would just say it was a modern relationship, modern 70s relationship where they had this borderline romance and platonic. And I channel me thinking about my mom at the time and say that if she ever needed motivation over if Felix had a line about being in love with his wife still, my mother would have seen him as just like one of her sons, and she would have been motherly to him. Mm. And so she was maybe a mother figure for Felix. Mm. That comes to mind.
Now, sometimes
I think that comes through in some scenes, in some episodes. And, you know, you're right to, when talking about the character that way as a modern woman, also she's very independent. You know, I mean, that's what you wouldn't have had as much on an earlier TV show. And remember, their relationship is based on her living in the building.
Right.
So they're neighbors. So, which makes it, I guess, kind of awkward if they had any tension between them. But it also, she has her own apartment. They're always going to like be hanging out because she's in the building, but they also have their distance. So it is her independence is one of the biggest things about her.
And don't tell me those hot pants didn't get the attention of other good looking exactly. gentlemen.
We just don't have the Miriam spinoff to show her side of the story.
So sometimes actresses create backstories for the characters. We never found out what Miriam did for a living. Do you think your mom ever thought about that and came up with a backstory for Miriam?
I don't think she did, because if it wasn't needed, she didn't. I've worked with actors who would do that. When I worked in production for a while, and I'll say never in the creative side, I know actors. Steve Franken, who was a very talented actor, appeared on Bewitched at least once. I was working on a show called The Human Target and introduced myself to him, and we were having a fine little conversation. And then it was time for his character to go into the scene that they were filming. And he used me to go into the scene. He acted like he had bumped into somebody in the hallway and was saying goodbye to them as he walked in. And he actually did that and said, "We'll talk later," and waved goodbye as he walked into the scene that they were filming. And that is somebody who a backstory helped. I think my mom was enough of a professional that if it said, you know, Miriam just got home from work and she's tired, my mom, raising four boys, knew what it was like to be exhausted and also knew what it was like to come home from work and be tired. So she would just do that. I don't think she had to do an inner construction of a biography of how that worked. And also, as we've talked about on The Odd Couple, it's very possible she would have wanted to leave that canvas blank, because if Gary and company wanted to write that in,
right,
she'd be ready to step into whatever they created.
Here's a quick question I just thought of. Peter, did she ever mention, say anything to you about Bobby Riggs?
Bobby Riggs, yes, they were very excited. That was a big deal, that episode with
that's a big episode for her.
That was on the list of the episodes I was going to cover. I'm glad you covered it. So keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I remember her saying they were both great, as far as I remember. And you guys are the experts. I'm an expert on my mother, but not on The Odd Couple. So you guys are going to have to jump in. But I remember that both were good and well, and there was some scene where they didn't film it in front of the audience. I remember that, and I don't remember why.
Probably the ping pong game.
Ping pong scene, and it was done without the audience. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember why I know that. But they either pre-shot it or they filmed it.
Yeah, that would make sense, because they were actually playing ping pong. They didn't want to mess up in front of the audience. Yeah,
probably.
And they probably had to reshoot it a bunch for gameplay reasons. Right. But did she interact with him much that she ever told you?
Not that I'm remembering. I mean, she probably interacted with every guest star in some way. She's not an aloof person. I'm not going to name them, but I've heard of actors. Again, I've worked in the business myself for a long time and have many friends who still work in the business. And they'll tell me about the actors they worked with, recognizable actors who would not say anything to them out of character. Even if they approached them and said, "Good morning, I'm happy to be working on your show," they would just kind of give a grunt and walk away, even though their characters would interact throughout an episode. My mom wasn't like that. She was a fellow professional, and so I'm sure she chatted with Bobby as well as anybody else.
How often have you watched the show in general or her episodes? Are you a frequent viewer of The Odd Couple, or casual and haven't seen it in a long time?
have not seen it in a long time. I would have seen them when they aired. We have a tradition in the had a tradition in the family and the household I grew up in. We would watch whoever show was on, and if it was a Harry Ackerman show or if Eleanor Donahue was co-starring in an episode of this, and we would wait till their name was on the credits and we would clap. And my first acting gig was on a syndicated show my dad did called The New Gidget, and that started as a TV movie called Gidget's Summer Reunion. And because I was in that in a small part, I got to sit in my parents' household to watch it, and they clapped for me for once when my name came up on the
and
screen.
You played a surfer, if I recall from the
I
book.
Did.
Yes.
Vince Van Patten and two other guys. I was one of the other guys.
Now, she was involved, and you may not have details about the episodes, but I have to recite it. She was involved in so many of the classic episodes. It's pretty remarkable. She wasn't just on the show. Password episode. My personal favorite episode, I Gotta Be Me, with the role reversal scene, I don't know if that means anything to you. She was in My Strife in Court, and that's the episode I was referring to earlier. This is the episode where, I don't know if you know this, Peter, maybe you do, the phrase, if you assume you make an ass out of you and me, comes from The Odd Couple, comes from that episode.
No kidding.
Yes, it does. And it's not in the script of the show. The script we have, it's not in the script of the show. We think it's something maybe Jerry Belson came up at the end. She is in that episode. That's a famous episode. She's in Let's Make a Deal. She's in Take My Furniture, Please. Pig Who Came to Dinner with Bobby Riggs. She also got to meet J.P. Morgan because she's in the songwriter episode, which leads to the famous song, do you know the song Happy and Peppy and Bursting with Love from The Odd Couple? Are you familiar with that?
I remember there was such a song. I think I saw the episodes on their first run only. Mm-hmm. Because of my desire to be an actor, and I was doing plays in high school, college, and then around LA. And when I got into my other vocation, or even when I was in production and I worked in television myself, I didn't watch a lot of television because I was so immersed in the production end of things.
So did she ever? Yeah.
Sorry.
Does any of those episodes, do you ever recall anything she's shared over the years about being in these, what did become iconic episodes? I mean, you've been now alive with her, you know, for the past couple decades. These have become iconic pieces of television, these episodes. Has she ever, you know, the Password episode in particular, has she ever dropped any little nuggets about any of the specific episodes to you?
No, the nuggets I always got, as I've shared with you, have either been with I was on the set or I heard her talking about something. I don't sort of interview her, so I don't. And because I don't watch something, like if I happen to watch The Odd Couple tonight and she's on it, she and I talk on the phone every Sunday. I might say, oh, I saw you on The Odd Couple on, you know, Friday, and it was this episode with, and you said this or this happened, and that might prompt something. But she doesn't just kind of bring things up, and I don't just interview her. So that's a good point. I'm seeing her for the first time since 2016 in person. I'm flying out to
wait. You haven't seen her in 8 years in person because of COVID.
Yeah,
and all of that? Wow.
What happened is I lived on the East Coast. I moved out of California in 2004 for what was supposed to be just 3 years. I ended up staying on the East Coast for 15 years. And then when an opportunity came for me to move back to California, I did in late 2019. And I was in Northern California. And it was great to be in the state with all my relatives. I got to see a couple of my brothers again, got to see my nieces who are adults. And it was all great. And Mom was going to come from Southern California and work her way up to Northern California and visit everybody on the way with my stepdad. And then COVID hit. And so the Sunday phone calls continued, but we were never able to kind of hook up. And then because my wife got this job offer and the clock was ticking for me to find something so that she could take it on the East Coast, just the quickness of finding a job and moving, I never had the opportunity to travel all the way down to the southern part of the state to visit Mom in person. So this is it. This April, we're celebrating our birthdays together. Okay. She's the 19th, I'm the 22nd.
But you're on the East Coast now as we talk to you, am I right?
I am. I returned to the East Coast, which is why I haven't seen her since 2016. 2016, I actually flew to Las Vegas. She was invited and paid, I understand, a princely sum. I never talk money with her, to appear at a Star Trek convention as the VIP guest one day of the convention. And she negotiated having one of her sons with her just to have somebody to hang out who she knew. And that was me. And so that's when I saw her last in 2016. And just we'd never been able to make it work.
That's a great segue. I just want to point out that Garrett had to go, as Peter and I were saying. Hopefully he went out to buy Peter's book, but he had to leave. So I will be continuing for the rest of the podcast. Now, we share a love of Star Trek. Your mom was on Star Trek. I mean, it's so funny to talk about your mom because you think of, I for this podcast, I think of her as Miriam, but then you get into her career and it's iconic show and iconic show after iconic show. And it just like, it doesn't stop. So you love Star Trek. I know that from the book. Mm-hmm. I love Star Trek. And your mom was on the episode with the companion. She played the companion. But what's interesting about that episode, first of all, so you were just saying she was at a convention. What is her thought, opinion about being part of this fan frenzy show? She relished it. She was like, it's just another job, which I know so many actors say. She embraces it. She's thrilled to be on it versus not. How does she treat it? Maybe today doesn't matter, but over the course of her career.
It was a job, as you say. It was just, I was hired for this. I'm going to do this. And she did it. And she, liked it. And she's done plenty of interviews around the show and how she, there's a iconic in the episode, it's called Metamorphosis, where she wears a scarf, and apparently she got the flu and they filmed around her for a couple of days. But when she came in, she was thinner than when she started. So to hide the weight loss because of the stomach flu, they put this thing around her head, which kind of covered the fact that she had lost so much weight and her jaw was sticking out more or something. And that's kind of all I know about it. And it was just a job. She's always thrilled about any show. I told her I'm going to be on this podcast in The Odd Couple. And she's like, well, what are you going to talk about? And she hadn't read my book yet. And I told her, and we've covered it already. And I didn't say I was going to talk about the hot pants thing.
You brought that up. I want to make that clear. I didn't bring that up.
It's otherwise the elephant in the room. So you're I have to bring it up.
Fair enough.
She said to me, she goes, even about doing this podcast, she said, I just can't believe it. She goes, I was just working. That's all I was doing. I was doing these jobs and I was going from one job to the next. And she goes, I'm amazed that there are people today that look at these shows deeply and just love them and know things that I don't even remember about them. And so that's answers the question, I think.
Yeah. And she hit, if you just take Father Knows Best, Odd Star Trek, Odd Couple, Andy Griffith and Friends, she's on five of the most beloved. The word iconic is overused. Even saying it's overused is overused, but she was. And so it's amazing. And I can imagine her getting it. She gets it from fans of so many different types of shows that not many people have had that sort of career. And she isn't on the shows that many times. She barely on Andy Griffith. She's on, Father Knows Best is probably the least known today because it didn't syndicate that well. It's still such a big part of television history. Now, what's interesting about the Star Trek episode, which I didn't remember until I rewatched the episode recently, her role on the show, she's not this alien creature. She's playing a Federation commissioner, which when I saw the episode, I was like, wow, this is how forward-thinking Gene Roddenberry was. It was a female Federation commissioner, which sounds like a very high position. And most TV shows in 1967 would have had a man play a commissioner because the idea of a woman being that high up. So did she, again, probably something she doesn't recognize, but did she realize you thought about the fact that she was playing a very senior female position of power in this universe in this episode, that she was really playing something quite notable at the time?
Yeah, I don't know that she did. And as I've pointed out, is that she always has played strong characters. As much as somebody else recently told me they counted in Father Knows Best between the shows the episodes, the original episodes and the two TV movies they made, Betty, her character, cried 63 times. And as much as Betty cried 63 times, Betty was a strong character. And Annie Griffith, she was definitely a strong character. So I think by the time she got to Star Trek, she had been playing strong teenager, strong 20-something young woman with a town sheriff. And so the Star Trek, which came a few years after that, she was used to playing these strong characters. So it was just another strong character. And that's how she would have seen it.
That makes sense. And on that show, you know, most of the women, you had Uhura, who was a strong character, but a subordinate to the captain. And you had a lot of aliens. And you had Spock's mother, Jane Wyatt. And her, I mean, I'm probably missing somebody, but it's just pretty significant that, but most of the shows you mentioned, Star Trek clearly stands probably that episode has probably reached more people over time than most other things she did. So I think that's pretty interesting. And she, I guess she, whatever she remembers of the show, ultimately it was a pleasurable experience working on it versus not.
Yes.
All right. So I want to do a quick hit. Now, again, you're probably going to tell me you don't know any specific things about these shows, but I'd like to cover, I'm a big fan of 70s and 80s dramas. And I'm going to list the shows that she was on, and I'm going to pause, and you tell me if you recollect anything about her being on these shows. My guess is these are jobs. She went to work. She came home. You don't know anything about it. But she was on a lot of shows on dramas, not Father Knows Best type things. She was on Police Woman, Angie Dickinson. And I'm going to just pause. If you don't say anything, I'm going to move on. Police Woman.
I remember her doing it because all these shows, especially in this time period you're going in, I helped her with her lines. That was part of what I did. And I liked doing it. And I did it in the style she liked. She didn't like her. If she had a son do it or somebody else do it, sometimes a friend or something, she didn't want the person to act. She didn't want me to pretend to be Felix Unger. She just wanted me to read the line to her so she could say her line back. And I learned how to do that with her. And she was also very specific. She wanted to only be interrupted and stopped if she didn't say every word as written in the order that they were written in.
Wow.
And that's how she practiced her lines. So I never saw the Police Woman episode because it was either on too late. My dad was, again, going back to that kind of family, 50s family idea. I wasn't allowed to watch certain TV shows. You know, if it was on at 9 o'clock, which maybe Police Woman was, maybe it was 8, I don't know. But if it was on at 9 o'clock, I wasn't allowed to watch it.
I think that was a 10 o'clock show. That was a pretty brutal show. But no.
Yeah, so definitely I wasn't allowed to watch it. So I've never seen it.
No answer. So no,
I didn't. I did her part with her, but so I don't remember her saying anything about
Angie Dickinson tale. No. The Rookies with Kate Jackson was on that.
All right. So The Rookies, what I remember is she and Kate Jackson on that became friends.
Oh.
And I remember her mentioning about what a nice woman Kate Jackson was. And when Charlie's Angels became famous, my mom had her phone book, and I always look through my mom's phone book and just see who was written in there. And there was Kate Jackson in there with Kate Jackson's home number. And I was in high school and Charlie's Angels, and I've got Kate Jackson's home number. I didn't do anything with
it. Oh, no, that's a
shame. I'm a good kid. My parents raised me well. And I wouldn't want somebody. We had crank calls to my mom.
That's fair. I get it. It's fair to be respectful. Police Story. I'm not sure who was on that episode because that was an anthology show.
That was such an odd episode too, because they videotaped it. So it was really a different look.
Oh, I don't even think I've seen that episode. I'm trying to pull it up here. It's called Warning All Wives. And it's season 1, episode 3. That's really early. Sorry. I pulled up Police Woman, not Police Story. Here it is. She was in 2 episodes. One in season 4 called Ice Time, and one in season 5 called No Margin for Error. You probably don't know which one you're remembering was videotaped.
I don't know, but if we do the deep dive on Internet Movie Database,
that's right.
That was really weird about it. I don't remember her saying anything else, except I remember that was another one at least one of those police stories where I was her other. And you're going to get to it. She did a Barnaby Jones.
That was next. Yes. Let's get to Barnaby Jones. Yes.
I'll jump to Barnaby Jones.
Yes.
I never saw it until I think on one of the streaming platforms that I have, it was free. And I came across it and I said, oh, my mom did an episode of that. I'm going to watch it. And you know, I remembered the lines. I mean, when they came up.
That's amazing.
It's like, I remember those lines, doing those lines with my mom.
So that aired March. That's one of the last episodes of the show that aired 1980. So you're saying 40 plus years later, you're remembering that.
I would have been 1980. It would have been 17 or 18. Yeah.
So that's pretty incredible. And Buddy Ebsen, nicest guy in the world, everyone, I assume, as far as you know.
I happen to know. I was a waiter for a while in the early, mid-80s at a restaurant called Hamburger Hamlet in Sherman Oaks, and a lot of stars came in there. It was in the San Fernando Valley, and Buddy Ebsen used to visit a jazz club nearby. He loved jazz, and he would come in all the time, and he would take anybody's ear and talk to them about jazz, and you need to go to this club. Jazz is such a great genre of music. You need to really open yourself up to it. And nice guy and tall as maybe, except for the time Kareem Abdul-Jabbar came in, Buddy Epps is the tallest guy.
Oh, I never think of him being tall. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Another favorite person of mine, actress, also a crush from that show, is Lee Merriweather. So I don't know if that ever came up at all, getting to know her.
Just that they were also sort of professional friends. Maybe they would sometimes be up for the same parts, but my mom, whenever Lee Merriweather was on something, my mom would always speak highly of Lee. So there was some sort of friendship in there.
And then Chips, she was on Mork and Mindy, One Day at a Time. She did three Fantasy Islands. She was on Hotel and four Love Boats. And it sounds like now, look, what I'm seeing here, and I did not notice this before, is that on one of the Love Boats, her character was Betty Anderson in season 10, which I guess may have been her, I guess they did it because they knew who she was. Sounds like Love Boat she had maybe the most kind of fun with. You seem to mention that show more often than others. Is that because it stuck with her more, maybe?
I think so, because it was really a well-produced show. And they took their time with their episodes, their ensemble casts, making the stories within each episode fit. Because as you know, they had multiple guest stars in every episode. And so it was a well-crafted, well-produced show. And often, there was some part where she was playing an abusive mother or something like that. And I ran into, I'm sorry, I'm not remembering his name, Captain Steubing. I ran into
Gavin McLeod.
Gavin McLeod, and mentioned who my mother was at the time when I ran into him. And he said, your mother is the most marvelous actress. They don't give her enough credit. And I'm so glad we had her on. She did this episode where she was this mother and she was just fantastic. And so I appreciate hearing that from a professional like him, because I know it as well, that she is a really good actress.
Can I say that was actually a very good Gavin McLeod impression?
Thank you. I've always been a good mimicker, but if you said in 2 weeks you see me somewhere and you say, do Gavin McLeod, I won't be able to do it.
Oh, well, I'm glad you did it here. Good timing. I loved Hotel. She does all this. And then in the 90s, she reinvents herself with an iconic, sorry, I'm not using that word, with a... brilliant but canceled show that people love. And she just does it again with Get a Life, which I was such a big Chris Elliott fan on Letterman. And then the idea that he had his own sitcom was for me thrilling at the time. And I watched an episode today to remind myself, by the way, do you know there's an unaired pilot that your mom is not the star of? They're not the mother.
I knew that she was cast after the pilot was shot, when the show went to series, they recast.
I know who it was. I'm seeing if you know who
I think it was somebody from Lost in Space.
Yes. But June Lockhart, yes.
June Lockhart. Yeah. Thank
June
you.
Lockhart plays the mother. So what does she, what is her, you were obviously more adult then. What can you say about her time on Get a Life and that it, you know, kind of became a cult show? That's the word I want to use, not iconic. Right. I want to use a cult show. Talk about Get a Life.
She had such fun on that show. One, because where it was filmed, Sunset Gower Studios was the property where they filmed Father Knows Best. So she was kind of back home. They may have even filmed on the same stage that Father Knows Best had been on. So there was this sense of coming home and being in the familiar. And one thing she loved about it is the cultish part of it was that she and Bob Elliott were only seen in their pajamas. That was the ongoing joke. They were always in the kitchen in their pajamas. And so she would sometimes not, I don't know if she dressed in pajamas to go to work, but she definitely dressed comfortable. She didn't have to be primped and ready except for the neck up for camera, because she would just be in comfortable pajamas. And she loved that. She was so comfortable on that set. It was so easy to work with. Chris Elliott's partner, maybe writing partner, producing partner, I can't remember his name. Just great guys. And that was, it was a really good opportunity. It came at the right time. My dad suddenly got sick in January of 1991 and had to be hospitalized, and they thought it was, and I think it just was, pneumonia. And his pneumonia didn't go away like everybody else that went into the hospital in that wing at the time. And Dad succumbed on February 3rd of that year, and Mom had to go to work. She was under contract. They weren't going to stop doing the episodes, and she was kind of a key person. It wouldn't be the same if suddenly Mom wasn't in the kitchen with Bob Elliott. So, and the Sunset Gower Studios was very near the hospital. So it was a trying time for Mom, because she would go to Sunset Gower after stopping by the hospital in the morning, stop back at the hospital at lunch, go back to work on the set, and then at the end of the night, go to the hospital, be with my dad, sometimes through the night, and then go to the studio in the morning, often coming home and getting ready for the next day. So it was a tough time for her, but I'm kind of glad she had that. It probably, with a lot of us humans, giving us something to do or having something to do in trying times makes it easier. It just gives us somewhere to focus.
I know that experience. Yeah.
And when my dad's funeral was, I remember sitting there grieving and looking up as the people were going to their seats and saw Chris Elliott there. And that meant a lot to me.
And how old was your dad when he died?
My dad was 78. So he wasn't a young man. He was 25 years older than her when they got married. She was 25. He was 50.
Yeah. Still, you know, young, not young, but also, yeah, it's earlier than maybe was necessary for whatever that means. And so did you go on that set at all? Did you get to meet Chris or Bob?
I did. I got to meet them both. And Chris was, when I went, was just engaged. And I don't remember, I think he was probably also a producer on it. And
yes, I think
he was a writer. So yeah, he was just very engaged, and it was just a very perfunctory, you know, kind, but perfunctory, nice to meet you. And Bob Elliott either wasn't very talkative, or if I'm remembering correctly, they were in the middle of shooting. My mom asked me to come by and visit her, and I did. And he was nice. I remember Chris and Bob wrote a book together around that time. And
I had
Mom take it to this studio. I've got it somewhere. And they both signed it, but Bob Elliott wrote, "Keep hanging by your thumbs." And I don't know what that means, but the fact that Bob Elliott wrote it, I love it.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, I think we're going to stop. I want to play two clips. I want to talk a little about your career, because your career history is also very interesting. And then we'll let you go. But, you know, I hope, you know, you realize this, but I hope your mom can take a step back and realize how significant her career is, how she's touched so many different audiences with so many beloved roles, and roles that aren't even necessarily that long. that to have that many roles on that many shows, be that remembered for so many different things, that is so rare, I think, in Hollywood. And to be someone who's no one says a bad word about, everyone seems to like. I mean, she truly had a kind of a charmed career in many ways, I think.
She did. And I think she's good at what she does. Again, I'll go back to the good actress. She's good at what she does and she's memorable. Unfortunately, the place that's supposed to remember people like her, the Television Academy, for a long while didn't remember her. And I remember finding out that they did a night celebrating classic television and she wasn't invited.
That's bad.
And what made it worse is that my dad was once president of the TV Academy. So even as his widow, she didn't get invited. Now I think she gets invited to things there and she's retired. So she doesn't want to go. So the two never met. When she would have gone, she wasn't included.
That's a shame.
But it's the fans. It's the fans that keep these shows alive and keep them watched and loved.
Right.
And she's amazing.
And of course, when I say charmed career, the you don't have a charmed career if you don't have the talent to start with. So that goes without saying that she can do many different things. All right. I want to play two clips for the fans just so we acknowledge it. So this is a clip from I Love Lucy. And either you know this clip, but if you don't, hopefully it'll surprise you. And the fans will understand why. In this episode, Lucy and Ethel and another friend are having a little party with the husbands of those three people. And the husbands have gone off to the kitchen to talk. And Lucy and Ethel and the other friend are annoyed that they're not all together. And this is what happens in that scene.
Oh, frankly, I think it's going to be a good thing for television.
Ricky, Bill, Fred.
Yes?
Come on in here with us.
Yeah, come on.
Okay.
Sure, right in.
How do you think color would take? Color? Well, there are two schools of thought on this matter. Some people think that, it's just around the corner. Others feel it's going to be a year or two.
We didn't exactly stampede the goats, did we?
Maybe we better go down to Abercrombie and Fitch and see if they sell goat mating calls.
You know, this is pretty insulting.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm going to do something about this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come on.
No, I read an article by Harry Ackerman the other day. He was talking about the caller.
All
it was
right,
going to be a lot.
Break it up.
What
come
are you
on.
Doing?
Yeah, right on here.
All right.
So are you aware that your dad is mentioned on an episode?
I didn't know that. I know he appears on an episode. I, in face only, non-speaking. I have heard Ackerman on I Love Lucy, and that's how I found out my dad had a connection to it, as I was watching it one afternoon. And it's one where Ricky is not going to be at the club anymore. They've gotten rid of him, and they brought in a new singer. So Lucy gets Fred and Ethel to help her with her scheme, which is to go in as different couples. They keep changing disguises and going in and finding out Ricky Ricardo's not going to be there. Cancel our reservation. We're leaving. And in one of those attempts, they leave, and Lucy, in whatever pretend character she is at the moment, says, "We must call the Ackermans and let them know not to come." And I ran into where my parents were, and I said, "They said our name on I Love Lucy." And Dad said, "Yes, I used to be a part of the show."
What episode does he appear on? Do you know?
I think it's early on in the show, and it was a remade version of the pilot.
Oh, okay.
And Lucy, I think, is performing because Lucy finagles her way to performing in the club because there's two Hollywood producers in the club watching. And the Hollywood producers, the camera cuts to them ever so briefly. And it's Jess Oppenheimer, the producer of the show.
Okay.
And my dad.
That's fascinating. All right. And now I just, because I feel like we can't talk about your mother and not play a clip from her and just celebrate her talent. I've chosen my favorite Miriam moment, which for our podcast is meaningful because, as I said, this goes back to the first episode we ever celebrated when Garrett and I were starting to do this. Are you aware, actually, I should bring this up. Were you aware of the big season one versus the rest of the Odd Couple debate that happens? Are you aware of this?
No.
Okay.
No.
So season one of The Odd Couple, which Miriam is not on, was filmed in a single camera in a different set than Miriam, than your mother was on, more like the movie. And there's a laugh track, and it's a completely different looking show. And there's there's a big divide in the Odd Couple community of people who like those episodes and people who do not. I have been very vocal that I cannot stand season one episodes. I don't watch it. We didn't cover it on the podcast, except we did one episode to quickly go through all 20 of them or whatever there are. Then we had on a fan of the season one episodes to tell us why they think it's merited. So when we started this podcast and we knew we were going to go in order and we knew we weren't going to do season one, we just decided to start with one of our favorite episodes. And it happens to be an episode with your mom on it. And one of the best scenes in this episode is this. To set it up for you, Peter, you may not know the episode. It's the episode you have the script for, The Pen is Mightier, where Felix is doing a writing course and becomes obsessed with being this great writer. And Miriam and Oscar know he's a terrible writer, and he's learning exercises on how to be a better writer from this writing instructor who Oscar thinks is a big fake. And I think the scene will speak for itself.
What's that noise?
Fix the radio.
The music interrupted my train of thought. Now I've got to get back on the track. Train, track. You see, I'm writing all the time. I rhyme all the time. Rhyme all the time. Huh, very good. Anything. Table, label, mabel, gable, sable. Chair, fair, hair, dare, compare. Rug, chug, lug, mug. Orange, fruit, boot, loot, suit. Root, oh my.
Nutty, ruddy, funny, dunny, buddy. Miriam, delirium, come into my solarium.
He's still rhyming.
Still rhyming.
Last night I was afraid to pick up a glass.
She's such a great writer.
No, I haven't heard him this excited since we went to the opera and he sang along.
There's no stopping him since he got that A+ on the poem.
We got another poem. He gave this one to me last night. And I was both touched and offended at the same time.
Now, wait a minute, Miriam. If that's intimate, maybe I shouldn't hear it.
Oh, yes, you should. Are you ready? Your glowing eyes, your smiling face, your every move so filled with grace. And when sad fate doth make us part, 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 you'll live forever within my heart, heart, heart.
Sweet.
Sweet, but it sounds like I died, died, died.
Listen, he's gone bananas, this guy. You know, he bought an electric typewriter, a tape recorder that he takes every place. Yesterday, we were on the subway. Nowhere, out of the blue, suddenly, ooh, ooh, oh boy! Oh, metal tube, oh, mighty snake that weaves its way beneath the teeming masses. Everybody looked at us like we were nuts. That's the first time I've ever been embarrassed in front of a wino. I'd hate to be in your shoes when you have to tell him how rotten his work is.
When I have to tell him, you're the one that has to tell him.
Well, you're his girlfriend. You're the one he's writing the poems for. Besides, he wouldn't listen to me.
Who would he listen to?
Probably his teacher.
Well, then you have to go talk to his teacher.
That fraud, he's the one who's telling him how great he is. Besides, it would hurt Felix. Look at that. Usually I want to hurt him.
Felix Unger, you are brilliant! Resilient, one in a million!
I'll hurt him.
Have you ever seen that scene or know that scene at all?
You know, I it's not coming back to me hearing it. And I seem to be laughing at it for the first time. It, at the age I was when it aired, had I seen it, I wouldn't have gotten the glass joke.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that could have been the episode where my mom learned about words that are funny, because in the chug lug mug, listening of words, it's got the words with the hard endings, and I'm thinking, well, maybe that's where she got the lesson from Gary Marshall about what's funny, when they were probably coming up with what are some good funny rhyming words we can do.
One of the things you may not have picked up on there is at one point he picks up an orange and he tries to rhyme with orange, and there's no words I guess that rhyme with orange, and he struggles, and it's very funny. So I just wanted to, I was trying to think of a way to make sure that we all hear her, and I think that that's arguably one of her best scenes. I'm sure other fans will say other things. All right, so you and I share similarities in that you wrote that growing up, TV Guide was your Bible, TV Guide was my Bible. You love the fall preview issues. I love the fall preview issues. You read the trades. I read the trades. You think yourself as a walking encyclopedia of show business, as do I. Can you talk about that a little bit and what that meant to you growing up?
Yeah, it I don't know why. I mean, the TV guide was great because the imagination, we didn't have so much chance to watch media back then, you know? So you had to wait for the shows to come on at night, and especially that fall preview issue, man, you'd see all these shows and the possibilities that were out there, you know, Logan's Run, Planet of the Apes.
Oh my God. You're naming my favorite shows. Logan's Run. I just got the DVD of it for like Christmas.
Yeah. There was one that I had hopes for. My mom did an episode of it called Feather and Father, and Harry Gardino, who's in The Sting, plays a con man. And I was into magic, which is very closely related to con games. And so I loved con films and con TV shows. And so I had such great hopes for that, and it got canceled, and just, oh, it was just so fun. And then the trades, one, I would always kind of look for my name because of who I was related to. I was on some list. And so around my birthday, my name would be listed.
You talk about that in the book. I found that interesting. Yeah.
And until it wasn't. And the trades too would talk about movies in production or in development, and just, and I don't know if I put this in the book, the one that got away, and I keep thinking there's got to be a cut somewhere. Even though I'm not a big fan of the movies, I've seen them, Smokey and the Bandit 3. I remember one of the trade papers had the poster for Smokey and the Bandit 3. And then the subtitle was Smokey is the Bandit. And it had drawings of Jackie Gleason as both the sheriff and the bandit. Hmm. And I thought that was brilliant. And I'm a, you know, love comedy. And so I wanted to see Jackie Gleason play all these roles. And when the third movie came out, it was no longer called Smokey is the Bandit. It was just Smokey and the Bandit 3. And Jerry Reed was playing the Burt Reynolds role. And I think you can read this on Internet Movie Database. The final movie with Jackie Gleason playing both parts didn't work with test audiences. So they went back and shot all the Burt Reynolds parts with Jerry Reed. Whatever it was going to be, didn't come to pass. But I just loved I guess maybe my imagination would overwork what this could be and what this could look like. And I wanted to see it. And so that's one that's got away, but I keep thinking that somewhere somebody has an original print of the before final Smokey and the Bandit 3 that has Jackie Gleason doing all the parts.
I didn't know such a thing was filmed. So that's an interesting, that is,
you. I do because of the trades.
Again. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Are you a Honeymooners fan?
Honeymooners fan, yes, when they're on. Again, as you can tell, I'm an avid reader. That's the one thing I kind of inherited from both my parents. And so I do more reading for fun, hard-boiled detective novels, that sort of thing, than I watch TV. So there was a big Honeymooners kind of kick back 20 years ago or so, and the Honeymooners are being shown again quite regularly. And I still will catch, they're shown sometimes on streaming channels, the color specials that they did. And so, yeah, I love them. I love the characters.
So I'm going to mention two. You mentioned Magic and Con Shows. I'm going to mention two shows, see if you watch them. I'm not a fan of them, but I'm curious. Switch with Robert Wagner and Eddie Albert.
I never saw Switch. I think I used to have, I collect tie-in novels, and TV tie-in novels.
I have some of those as well, yes. And so you have a Switch one.
I had a Switch one. Again, part of my downsizing, I had too much stuff that I was carrying across the country back and forth. But anyway, I know Switch, never saw it.
How about The Magician with Bill Bixby?
Oh, I love The Magician.
So I watched that on DVD recently for the first time. Maybe as a magic fan, it's better. I finished the show, but I was mixed. Also, I don't think I love Bill Bixby. I don't ever really got into the whole courtship of his father, Goodnight Beantown. I think I'm not a huge Bill Bixby fan. That probably didn't help, but you know and love the show.
When it came out, and I was probably 13, you know, it was great. It was had everything you wanted. Action, magic. I too have the DVD set, and I don't think I got through two episodes.
Okay.
And watched the rest later, but it didn't have the punch that it did for the 13-year-old me.
Yeah, I've had that with other shows. So before I get to you, where you are now in your career, and you made a pretty big switch. Speaking of switch, you got to be on the original Batman set.
Please
tell us about that.
First set I ever went to, I'm not sure why, except maybe my dad just wanted to do a nice thing for his sons. And in fact, it's the cover of my book, Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV. You don't know it because the picture is scaled down. It's just my mom, dad, and me. But we went to the Batman set. My dad knew Bill Dozier, who was the producer of Batman and also the, announcer, on the show. And, my older brother Brian and I loved it. So we went down to the studio, and we were also supposed to go to the stage that had the monkeys. And because we were monkeys fans, my dad working as the vice president of Screen Gems production at the time, vice president in charge of production at the time, he was executive producing shows, had access. We had free monkeys albums and later free Partridge Family albums. And so I was excited. And when we got to the studio, the gate was down, 20th Century Fox Studios. The wooden arm of the gate was down on the side, and my dad drove up, and the guard is kind of holding out his hand. It's because the gate's not there to stop the cars. And he goes, "Oh, hello, Mr. Ackerman." And my dad said, "What happened to the gate?" And he goes, "Oh, that Peter guy from the monkeys drove through it this morning. Couldn't wait for me to lift it." And my mom turned to my brother and I and said, "Well, I don't think we're going to that set today." And I'm like, "Oh," but we went to Batman, and, Hot Off the Griddle was the name of the episode. And the scene they were filming was Batman and Robin getting a hot foot while Catwoman is sitting above them, gleefully watching with a couple of henchmen. And
you know which Catwoman it was? Which Catwoman was it? Julie Newmar, Eartha Kitt, Merriweather. Julie, she's my favorite. Yeah.
And he came over and took a picture with my brother Brian and I in Stately Wayne Manor with my mom and dad. And I cut out older brother Brian and Adam West from the.
Oh, I'm looking at the picture of the cover now. I didn't realize that. Obviously you have the full version.
Yeah. And if you add me on Facebook, I'm under my author name, which means I include my middle initial, Peter K. Ackerman. And I also have started a Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV Facebook page that people could go to, and I'll find that picture yet again, and I'll share it to that page so folks can see it if they want to.
Did he sign it for you?
He did later, not then, because then it was just taken by some studio photographer.
Oh, got it.
A month later, Dad said, "Look, we got this picture," and I kept it. And one day, Adam West was signing at some comic book store, and I went and stood in line, and I'm probably in my 20s at this point. And I said, "I've met you before." And I slid the picture in front of him, and he looked at my parents, and he, in very Batman voice, you know, he went, "I know these people." And I said, "Yes." And I told them who my parents were and that I was the little boy in the picture. So he signed it to my old pal, Peter. And I cherish that.
It's really a great picture. And you got to see that where they jumped into, you got to see the Shakespeare bust, and that the poles they jumped down, which we all know, but you know, you confirm that it just jumped down to a bunch of mattresses.
Yes. My brother and I walked over, and there are the bat poles, and we looked down, and it's just a bunch of mattresses. And that to me was a turning point, because that could either turn a kid away from show business, like, "Oh, the magic is spoiled. I don't want to be a part of this." Or I was in on the secret, and I was like, "Oh, so the Batcave's really not down there. I get it. This is how they make the show." And I was so young. You can see in the picture on the book cover how young I am. And you know, if Batman, when was it? 66 to 68?
Yep. It's 66 to 68 or 69. Yeah. A couple of seasons. Yes.
Yeah. A couple of seasons, maybe just 66 and 67. So I could only been at the most 5 years old. But I got it. I got what this thing called TV was, and it was making magic. And I was into it. And that kind of led me to my first forays into careers.
three seasons, January 66 to March of 68. Could you have stolen the Shakespeare bust if you would you have if you were a little older?
Who would I, you know,
the bust of Shakespeare that they opened up to? I would say, would you have considered stealing it if you were in your teens?
Never stealing. I was brought up not to do that. Fine. I might have pushed the button if I thought it would do anything, you know.
Did you? But you did not.
Or lift the phone at me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the phone. Okay. So you, in the book, you talk about that you worked a fair amount in production and television and movies afterwards. And then you made a big shift. And I'm not going to spoil what you are now. So why don't you talk about how that, what you did and how that transition happened?
Okay. Well, after trying to be an actor, and I did a few things that are not of note, they're out there. And I don't know that I even show up on an internet movie database. And if I do, I'm like Peter Ackerman, number four. And eventually when my dad had knee surgery while he was doing the new Gidget, he needed a driver for a couple of weeks. So I volunteered. I took a leave of absence from my waiter job, which is what we actors did. And, drove my dad. And it was the first time as an adult that I got to see what my dad did, because I went everywhere with him. So I got to see the editing sessions and putting on the laugh track. And I got to listen to, I wasn't allowed in the room, but I got to listen to the casting sessions while I sat in the room outside when the actors went in. And I just got fascinated with production and decided I wanted to be in that. And my dad didn't want to take a job away from anybody else. So he wasn't going to make any show hire his son. He said, I got to find my own jobs. So I had a contact who was married to my older half brother. My dad had some children with his first wife. And so Francine Selkirk was her name, and she was a producer in commercials. And so I went to her and started doing production assistant work in TV commercials. And then I started getting jobs on my own. It was a freelance position. I did it for 5 years, and I worked on music videos with Madonna and Peter Frampton and Aerosmith and all that. And then finally got hired to work a TV series for a short time and a couple TV series. And then I was working in the main television department for the Warner Brothers vice presidents who oversaw the Warner Brothers TV shows. And finally got onto a couple shows as something other than a production assistant. I was a production coordinator on the Wayans Brothers for one season, the first season. And then my friend who I've done some pilots with, Todd Stevens, he was the line producer on Friends. And after season one, his assistant left and he said, do you want to come on and be my assistant? I said, yeah. So I became his assistant for two seasons. And that's the closest my mom and I got to working. She was on season one and I worked season two and three. And while on Friends on season two, I'm happily married. My wife and I had our two children. They were very young at the time. I'm a person of faith. I've always belonged to what's called the Episcopal Church and liked my faith, liked my church. But I wasn't feeling it in show business. I just wasn't feeling it. So I decided to take a job hiatus. And I got a regular 9-to-5 job in a property management office and just decided I'd figure out what I wanted to do. And suddenly my church wanted somebody to be on staff as their youth leader. And I interviewed for it, got it, and loved it. And then a job opened up as the parish's administrator. And I'd been doing administrative work in television. So I took that job as well. I'm working I guess the youth job is part-time. So I'm working a job and a half at the same church. And then people began to say to me, have you ever thought about the priesthood? And I started to think about it. And other people and the kids started to say, you should be a priest. And there's a whole process you have to go through. You don't just go to seminary. But I went through that process to discern if I was called to the priesthood. And in the priesthood in the Episcopal Church, obviously, we can be married and have kids. So that wasn't a problem. And my bishop wanted me to go to a seminary in Virginia, and he paid to move my family and I there. And while I was in Virginia, we found we loved it. We loved the school system out there for our kids. And when I was doing an internship in my senior year, that church wanted to hire me and we wanted to stay. So I ended up staying on the East Coast for 15 years. as I've already mentioned, 2019, we get to choose our own jobs, by the way, in the Episcopal Church. There's a listing of what jobs are open, and you apply and you interview and you get or you don't, or you decide to take your name out if you interview and don't like it. So with our kids now adults, Marie and I decided in 2019 to go back home to California. And for various reasons, including COVID, we found that it wasn't home. And Marie's job, she's a sommelier, a wine and spirits expert, and a restaurant manager. And her job here on the East Coast wanted her back. So it was up to me to find a job out here. And we did. In 2022, I returned to the East Coast. So here we are. We live in St. Mary's County, Maryland now. And I'm a what's called a rector, which is the head priest and only priest at a church called Christ Church in Chaptico, Maryland. So come look me up if you're ever in town.
When we were talking and deciding, you know, when can we talk? And you said, well, we were talking about Sundays. Well, I can't do Sundays because it's my job time as Episcopal priest. That was not, you know, what I expected you to tell me you were doing. That was definitely a big switch from where the Hollywood connection. So that's really fascinating. It's great that you found your calling, so to speak, and something you really love.
And the reason I wrote the book as well, not only to so people will remember my parents and their contributions, but also it allows me through podcasts like this to, I love my parents and their contributions to classic television. And so I love showbiz. I just didn't like working in it as much as I was. So this allows me to kind of keep my hand in. And so I've got the best of both worlds. I'm doing a vocation that I feel I was really called to do. And I still get to be in the showbiz world.
Well, I want to thank you for writing the book. I know I said in jest earlier, I was angry that your father didn't get a chance to record his memoirs or didn't, but you have done that for him. And I do think his contributions should be celebrated today as much as your mom's are. So I'm appreciative that you wrote the book as a, somebody who gobbles up memoirs about classic TV. It's really good. I highly recommend everyone go out and get it. Mom, Dad, Me and Classic TV by Peter K. Ackerman. And thank you for spending so much time with us on the podcast and be willing to come on. And it's been great. And thanks for connecting us, you know, as Odd Couple fans to someone, yeah. You know, the kind of the last remaining person from that core cast is your mom. And so it's great to have a living connection to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. And you've inspired me to dig out and start watching The Odd Couple again.
All right.
And to check out that first season. I don't remember it without an audience.
So. Yes. No audience. So, you know, you may like it, and I'm not admitting, I'm saying there are people like it, and I get it, and let them like it, and I'm not telling them not to watch it. I can't take it, but it would be interesting to see some like a newbie go and discover it and see how they kind of figure out the episodes that season versus the rest of it. And thanks everyone for listening, and thank you for Peter, and don't forget to get his book, and we will come back to you with another episode soon. Bye, Peter. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye.